Alan, what's the phenomenon where, and I think this is true of like at work or at home, but like you get a piece of kitchen equipment, and at first, maybe you're like, oh, I'm not sure if I fully know how to like utilize this equipment or something. And so, you know, maybe at first you're a little bit like intimidated by it. And then like, maybe you get over the intimidation factor, but you're still a little bit skeptical. Like you use it a few times and you're like, oh yeah, okay, but I don't know if it's exactly working how I think it should work or how I would want it to work. Or like, if I don't know, it's doing exactly what I thought it would. And I'm just not sure about this piece of equipment. And then some pieces of cooking equipment, they like earn like they earn their way into like feeling like something that you value, and that I don't know what the best word for it is, but it's like they like at some point they worm their way into your heart, and suddenly they're like, I don't know, they have sentimental value in like that you really enjoy using them, and they feel like an indispensable part of what you want to use in your kitchen, and you start to like become attached to them. You start to become like proud of them. You're like, oh, I'm proud of you,
So what's the
you
example?
little. So today I had some friends over for dinner, and like this week I watched a bunch of Kenji videos, and one of the videos that he put out in the last little while was mushu pork. And I haven't really had mushu pork at like a lot of Chinese restaurants. I don't know if I've ever ordered it, honestly. Just maybe, I don't know, it didn't seem like that appealing to me. I was like, oh, it's just another stir fry or something. But like the Western version of mushu pork, you like eat it in pancakes. So I don't know why I wouldn't have been in love with that idea,
Right.
because like that's sort of like my favorite thing. Anyway, Kenji made mushu pork. I invited some friends over for dinner. I made mushu pork for them, and I used my wok. Like I've used it, you know, a fair amount in the last, I think I got it probably what, 6 months ago or something like that. But man, oh, I was just like so proud of my wok. It did such a good job. It did exactly what it was supposed to do. The first few times that I used it, like I tried to season it really well, and I tried to do like when you heat up your wok, I forget what the word is. There's a Chinese word for it, but when you heat up your wok, there's a specific way that you're supposed to heat it up. Like the same kind of way that you heat up a stainless steel pan. Like you heat it up quite hot, and then you put in oil and you kind of reduce the heat, and then you bring the heat back up to where you want it to be. That's supposed to create the nonstick surface. And I had like some luck with that previously, but like, I don't know. I always had like a little bit of like things sticking to it and stuff. But man, when I used it tonight, I scrambled eggs in there and it was like Teflon. It was crazy. It was so good. I was so proud of it. Good wok.
And so Mushu was
Yeah.
good.
Oh my God, it was delicious. It was really good. Have you ever had
I
it?
don't think so, no.
It's like, I think mushu is like mushrooms or something. And yeah, it's a stir fry with marinated pork and mushrooms and egg. And yeah, it's, you know, like it's a pretty simple stir fry, but man, it's delicious. And I made those spring pancakes for the first time ever, and that turned out pretty good too. It's a really interesting technique that I wasn't aware of, where you like roll them out flat, but you roll them out like with flour and oil in between them, and you roll out four at a time, and then you cook them, and the steam like pushes them apart. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that. We've
I
mentioned
don't.
this channel before, but I've watched the video on how to make it on that Chinese cooking demystified.
Yeah, that was the video that I mainly used for that as well. Kenji says that he has a video in the Mushu Pork episode. He's like, oh, there's a video about, I have a separate video about making the pancakes, but I think maybe something went wrong with it and he never posted it or something, because I
Oh, really?
looked all over Kenji's video uploads and I did not find a spring pancake video.
Chinese
So
cooking demystified's version was so much better than his, he just took his down probably.
maybe he did say that his pan, he said he was kind of ashamed of his pancakes. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my friend Alan Sutterby. How you doing, Alan?
Great.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it. Alan, do we have a topic for tonight? Just kidding. I know we have a topic.
Last night, you and I watched a movie.
Yeah. A movie that's like still in theaters, actually.
Yeah.
But we watched it at my house because that's just much easier.
Great. And because we're always trying to be Siskel and Ebert, and we have had several conversations now about food movies and asked each other what is the best food movie of all time. We watched this new movie with Ralph Fiennes and Anya Taylor-Joy.
Anya Taylor-Joy. Yeah.
Called The Menu, and it's very much about
it was pretty
food,
cool.
food and restaurants, yeah. and specifically high-end dining experiences. It's a thriller. It's violent. I don't know what to say. Anyways, we watched this movie last night, yeah. and it was really excellent, and we wanted to talk about it today.
That being said, the movie is still in theaters. I'm sure that there are a lot of people who are interested in food who may have decided to go and see it. And if you've seen it, great. But if you haven't, you might want to watch it before listening to the podcast, because we're probably going to spoil the heck out of it. So if you would rather not have it spoiled, and I highly recommend not having it spoiled, because I kind of knew what it was about going in, but I had tried to stay pretty spoiler free, and then I was pretty surprised within the first within the first maybe 40 minutes or so, it went in a pretty crazy direction that I was not expecting. So that was good.
Certainly by the fourth
course. So I would definitely recommend.
By the fourth course, you were definitely surprised at what happened, I think.
Definitely. Yeah. I think before then. So if you haven't seen it, watch it first and then come back and listen to this episode. And I don't know if it's streaming anywhere yet. Maybe. Or maybe available to rent or something. And I think it is still in theaters, so. So right off the hop, Alan, what did you think? Did you like it? Thumbs up, thumbs down, Siskel and Ebert style.
It's funny. I loved it. I thought it was really excellent.
Okay, good. Two thumbs up.
In terms of like thriller vibes, thriller slash horror vibes, it kind of reminded me in some ways of Get Out.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
Where it starts innocuously enough, but it is able to really ramp up the intensity really and take it into interesting directions. I was on a food level, I was really surprised at how specifically how precisely it was able to like hone in on these issues around what I don't know what the best term for it is, but for this conversation I think I'm just going to say high-end dining, but I mean like world-class, the San Pel top 50, blah, 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 Michelin star, blah, 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 the most prestigious restaurants in the world, how it was like really laser focused on specific issues around that industry right now. Things from like, you know, poor people feeding rich people and freely like the stagiaires and the free labor and the cult of the chef and sexual abuse and all of the crazy hours and stress and depression, anxiety, all of these things that are just like swirling around that part of the industry, all these issues that are swirling around that part of the industry, it's just like it understood them so well. And then,
yeah,
I guess you'd have to call this movie a satire. I don't even know what.
Yeah, I think so.
But I was actually shocked even more. Like we talked about, say, with The Bear and with other food movies, like, oh yeah, the person who wrote this must really understand something about cooking. But this was like next level, and not in terms of like, you know, how they show, you know, people searing meat or whatever, like not stuff like that, but just like in their understanding of the serious issues and complications of high-end dining as it currently exists, I was shocked at how smart it was, basically.
Yeah, and how accurate it was at diagnosing some of those problems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it seems like such a niche thing.
Yeah, I think I was too. I don't know if I would say necessarily that I thought it did a better job of that than the Bear does. Like, but it's kind of, it's hard, it's sort of hard because it's kind of like comparing apples to oranges a little bit, because the Bear has a much longer span of time to sort of like develop the ideas that it's trying to illustrate.
Right.
Whereas this has to sort of like, you know, it kind of does cover all of those issues that you named, and it kind of, you know, and it does it in like an hour and 45 minutes, like kind of has to like bang them out one after the other.
Yeah.
And also I think they chose like a really interesting way to sort of like approach that. It's sort of like, it doesn't exactly work this way, but the structure of the movie is like, done in like courses, like each like course in the dinner sort of has its own, it's sort of like its own little short or something, its own little set of things that happens, in each course. And so, yeah, by choosing that structure, they sort of like assign each course to sort of like illustrate a specific issue and dive into it and then move on.
Before we get too much further in, should we do a short synopsis? Very short.
Okay, yeah, we should do a short synopsis. Do you want me to do that?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, short synopsis. So it's about a super high-end meal that a bunch of diners are have reservations at or get invited to. I think there's, I don't know.
I think 12.
20? 15, 20 diners or something like that?
I was
going to
say 12, but I don't actually know.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. And it's on this, like fancy island where they like forage and grow a lot of the food that they use. And the people that work at the restaurant live on this island, and the diners have to take a boat to get there. And when they get there, the boat leaves, and they get a little bit of a tour of the island. They get sat down for dinner, and then dinner starts, and fairly shortly after dinner starts, and you kind of get a glimpse of like all of the diners, and the movie's kind of trying to show you that they're all pretty unlikable.
Or not sort all of
what
of
it
them.
felt like to me. most of them. Yeah. except maybe for Anya Taylor-Joy's character. What's her name at the beginning?
Her pseudonym, or sorry, her assumed name is Margot Mills.
Margot Mills. Yeah.
Yeah.
They all sit down to dinner, and there's kind of an air of like, I don't know, rudeness and intensity. When the dinner starts, it's like a very startling
thing. From the staff, you mean?
From the staff, yeah. And then dinner starts, and shortly into dinner, you sort of realize that each course is like a metaphorical concept that's meant to point out the negative aspects of the diner's personalities specifically. So the chef and the restaurant have done a bunch of research about the diners and brought them there because they think that they're bad people. And then you find out fairly shortly that the concept of the dinner is that the chef and all of the cooks have formed this like death cult, and they want to kill all these diners because they want to kill themselves and all these diners as a concept for this menu, because they hate their lives. They hate themselves. They hate the diners. They want to, say something that will be remembered, about high-end dining. So I guess they want to try and, use this evening to illustrate the point that that high-end dining is toxic or something like that.
Yeah, that's pretty well said, I think.
Right. And so the dinner progresses, and each course is like just like a horrible, violent, upsetting conceptual degradation or violent act against someone that's involved with the dinner. And the diners soon realize that they probably aren't going to get out alive, and people start to freak out. And then there's sort of like a plot that that kind of is set off from there. And I guess part of the conceit is that Anya Taylor-Joy wasn't actually invited. She was brought along without the chef's prior knowledge. Mm. And that sort of throws a monkey wrench into his whole plan, because she's sort of, he doesn't know anything about her really. And she's kind of an innocent in his eyes. And so he's trying to figure out, basically he knows that no one's going to leave the island alive, but he asks her if she wants to die with like the
givers or the takers.
Yeah, the givers or the takers. Yeah. And the takers being the diners and the givers being the service workers, mm-hmm. I guess. And so she has a little bit of an opportunity to sort of like work both sides of the situation. She gets put in a position where she kind of almost gets to escape and get some knowledge about the chef that maybe nobody else has. Mm-hmm. And then she uses that to her advantage at the end of the movie to be the only one who escapes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now that the movie is completely spoiled for everyone, intentionally, obviously we needed to,
I mean, we were going to talk about it sometime.
Yeah, no,
so
I know.
If you're still here, then you've either seen the movie or you've heard all about mm-hmm. it. So, mm-hmm. so let's roll.
Okay. So
where do you want to start, Alan? I think like maybe we should just like briefly talk about how the movie handles the, like you were saying, like it's pretty laser focused on this fine dining idea. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can have a brief discussion about like how it handles the like portrayal of like this like super high end, like fine dining stuff in the movie.
Sure.
How do you think that went?
So I was in that vein. So I was writing messy notes
okay.
while I was watching it. And afterwards, I tried to write down the issues or the ideas that it brought up that are specifically about, 'cause there's all kinds of ideas in the movies, like about, say, like, you know, sociology in like a kind of authoritarian environment, or like in a like group psychology and things like that. But in terms of the stuff about high-end restaurant culture and the issues and ideas around that, the ideas that I wrote down were that those restaurants are inaccessible due to price, that they feed the rich, which is something actually that came up in that Rich Roll interview with Daniel Hume that we talked about, right. Like kind of relatively not poor people, but like middle-class people or lower class people feeding the ultra rich. The idea that a lot of these restaurants are kind of like bolstered by investors, so that the restaurants themselves aren't even profitable at face value. They're just like, have all this money being injected into them.
Right.
That keeps them afloat. That the menus at these restaurants deal too much with ideas instead of like taste and nourishment and stuff like that. That the staff can be pretentious and condescending. That the staff is often largely comprised of unpaid stagiaires. The staff has like a cult-like mentality, like with that, you know, like shouting back, "Yes, chef," to everything. It has that culture of like toughness and like machismo kind of stuff. And then one thing that's like broadly, like not just the high end restaurant, but like in the service industry, that they often, the workers feel like they're not appreciated or understood.
Right.
They address sexual abuse and the power imbalance like along gender lines. And then most importantly for the concept of this movie is this idea of like the cult of the chef, right? The like myth making, megalomania, the idea of chef as artist, chef as martyr, like someone who's like giving his life, his or her life to the craft. And then that also like the chef, even though they are trying to present the team as this unified unit, they are always a different level than the people right. who are working for them, even the paid ones who are working for them. So yeah, those were the, in terms of the restaurant specific or high-end restaurant specific things, like those were the ideas and issues that this movie brings up. And I think like really nails them, like really like satirizes them perfectly, I think.
Right. I think in my mind, I was thinking like more just specifically about like the restaurant and the food before we get into like the heart of the discussion, which is clearly all of the, yeah, the political things that you were just talking about, like just like on a purely like visual and like on a level of accuracy, how do you think the movie did at like nailing like what that type of restaurant is like, mm-hmm. like the food and the setup and the
it did pretty
like the restaurant itself.
Yeah, it did pretty good. It was in my mind, like obviously I don't know what all of the exact inspirations were for it, but in my mind, right.
If you had to name
some, the restaurant is an amalgam of, I would say, first of all, Favikin, mm-hmm. in northern Sweden, now closed, but it was in northern Sweden, because of its remote location and the idea that the guests had to make special effort to travel there, and then once they were there, they were quite isolated. So Favikin wasn't easy to get to, and a lot of the people who ate there had like were given board there because there wasn't much accommodation around it. And also, I guess also the idea of like the foraging and the local ingredients, and they do specifically talk about how the restaurant Hawthorne in the movie has all these Nordic influences. So Favikin,
which I found a little weird because it seemed like it was an American restaurant.
It was definitely in America because it was the U.S. Coast Guard that was one of the actors in the movie. But I don't know if they ever say what state it's in, but it seems like it's in the northeastern United States. They mentioned the Nordic influence, and because of the remote location, Favikin was the first thing that came to mind. There were several small specific references that definitely were pulled from 11 Madison Park, which is a very different scene and location and everything. But in terms of the restaurant itself, first of all, the most important part of the layout of the restaurant is that it's an open kitchen, very close to the diners. And so that I haven't been to any of these places, but like, I know that El Bulli was like that, like where you can see the cooks working, preparing each
Noma
meal.
Is very much like that.
Is that right?
And and I haven't been to the new Noma, but I think it's structured very similarly to how this is represented in this movie. Mm-hmm.
The actual dining room itself in the movie didn't look, this is such a small thing, but like it looked very simple and not very comfortable. Like it was immediately adjacent to the kitchen, and just like the table settings and chairs, like didn't look comfortable to me. It looked like someone's like a household dining room, but
it's kind of sparse.
Yeah.
That felt very Nordic to me too.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. And I don't know what it's like in other, like I have only had like four or five experiences in restaurants of that caliber. I've definitely never been in one where there's only 12 seats and the actual chef is telling long stories about each dish. Like typically they might tell you that story, but it's the runner telling you that story or your server telling you that story. But the whole idea of storytelling and like basically not the food can't speak for itself. You need to understand this rather complicated or complex backstory to the dish is one of the main ideas of the movie, and also one of the most annoying things in contemporary high-end dining. And there's like,
I gotta say though, that like that to me, that part of it to me felt overplayed. Like, oh, yeah. I've been in a fair amount of like those high end fine dining restaurants, and it's never been like that.
No, but that's why it's, you know, satire. Like, the movie is satire, and that part in particular is satire, because the celebrity chef is not the one who's going to tell you that story, and they're not going to really spend that much time doing it. But to illustrate,
and like, even if the server has a story about the dish to tell you, like, it's usually a simple, like, oh, you know, like, it's, you know, it's not like, oh, the chef's childhood cookies were, you know, made out of this particular.
Well, okay.
Like, I don't
know. So the other specific restaurant that came to mind in terms of like for this movie was Osteria Francescana, okay. Where the storytelling is way more important than the food.
Oh, really?
Oh, okay. Yeah, absolutely. Like, for instance, like a couple of the dishes that I had there, like one of them is called, the name of the dish is an eel swimming up the Po River. So the Po River runs through Modena, where the restaurant is. And yes, it's a dish of eel, but also on the plate, there is, if I remember right, there's some kind of green apple component. There's a polenta component. There's an ash component. And the server points at each component and tells you what they represent. So this is the eel. The ash represents the city of Modena. The apple represents the, I don't remember what it was, the orchards, the surrounding orchards. The polenta represents the bountiful north. Whatever it is. Like, but it's like, this is a puzzle that you don't get to solve because we're telling you what it means. And there you go.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Some of those parts of it I thought were kind of like, yeah.
They're not realistic. Like, but to me, it's like, it's satire. And so it's like, point taken. Yes, it's overbearing. It's not realistic, but yeah.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah. I wouldn't say it bothered me, but yeah, exactly. Like, they're overplaying that to make a point, which is, you know, and the point comes across for sure. And I also don't think it was totally unrealistic to think that, you know, that could be the way that there's like one hilarious line. One of the main characters, what's the guy's name who brings Anya Taylor-Joy with him?
Tyler.
Yeah. So he's a real foodie.
Yeah.
And he's talking about the restaurant. He's talking about the food, and he's telling Anya Taylor-Joy's character about it. And at one point he says, oh, like, I've watched every episode of Chef's Table. Like, he says, like, I've seen him describe this dish on Chef's Table like 30 times. I've watched every episode of that show like three or four times. And I was just like, yeah, I've definitely seen some episodes of the Chef's Table where, like, they're, you know, like, they may not be in the restaurant presenting the dish with the story specifically, but like, you know, you talk to the chef about the dish outside of the service in the restaurant, and there definitely is like those types of stories and those shows, those types of shows. And there's like, you know, a lot of like cookbooks and things that are in a similar vein that like really play up that, you know, story concept and story aspect of the conceptual design of the food at these restaurants. So yeah, it's a real concept. I just felt like the way that it was represented in the movie was like a little bit over the top compared to what you would actually get if you went and sat down and had a dinner in one of these places.
But, well, actually, and I'm glad you mentioned Chef's Table, because one of the best one of my favorite parts of the movie is that even though it's structured as a thriller, really, to me, like something like Get Out, that style of thriller or horror. And yet, after each course is presented, it basically parodies Chef's Table by writing the title and the description of the course, like writing it out in text on the screen, in the same style that Chef's Table does. So I thought that was really clever.
Yeah. I like that. There's like sort of a wrapper around the whole movie that, yeah, feels like it's an episode of Chef's Table or something like that. Like the very beginning of the movie, like they show the like production companies, and then they show like, yeah, the production company that like made the film, and then like on the screen in like cursive font, just like white on black, like fine white cursive font on black, it says would like you to experience,
right?
And then the screen goes black and then the title of the movie comes up, The Menu. Like is it was very much like an episode of Chef's Table or something like that. It's funny.
But anyways, so your original question, like the feel of it, like
did the food and the restaurant. What about like the tour that the, so they get to the island on the boat and there's a host there to greet them. She's very mean. I never seen a host that mean in all of my years working in or visiting restaurants. I feel like if I book this exclusive table at a restaurant and I got off the boat and the host who was there to greet me was just like this super rude, super short, like curt person, I would be like, okay, this was a bad idea. I don't that seemed very unrealistic to me. I feel like, you know, especially before they even get them to the restaurant, you know, the host would just be like a host and like trying to greet people and make them feel comfortable, and you know, and that it was sort of like the opposite. Her attitude was sort of like, I don't have to do anything to make anyone feel comfortable.
I think before I had any experience eating at places like this, that was probably my perception of high-end restaurants, was that, oh yeah, they must be like it, whatever. Like we grew up, it's like, oh yeah, the snooty French waiter kind of thing.
Right.
Where they're superior and and arrogant. I would say on the surface, like this is the one thing that doesn't feel natural or realistic about the movie, because almost all of my experiences in Michelin starred restaurants, one of the most amazing things about them is that they really take hospitality seriously. And even if you're not from there or you don't really understand much about the food, like they make you feel welcome.
Yeah. Yeah. That's sort of like the thing for me that felt a little disingenuous about the movie is that, like, if you're trying to make it feel like a real fine dining restaurant, like, okay, sure. Once you get into the dinner where they're murdering people, then it makes sense for everybody to have a shitty attitude about the diners. But like when they arrive, the fact that the host was so kind of like gruff with them, I was like, this just doesn't feel real to me, you know, like the host would be like making everyone feel comfortable. Like, oh yeah. So like the kind of interaction that made me feel that way was that, like, so Anya Taylor-Joy gets off the boat and she's not supposed to be there. It's supposed to be this guy, Tyler's ex-wife, I guess. And he wasn't able to change the reservation. And so the host asks her who she is. It's like, who are you? Like,
right.
And then she says, are you Mrs. whatever Tyler's last name is, and there's a little bit of confusion, and then she's like, oh, you're not her? Okay, well, we'll do everything we can to make you feel comfortable. But then when they go to seat everyone in the restaurant, the host like says to her, you'll be sitting in Mrs. What's-Her-Name's spot.
Right. Yeah.
You know, which is just like a thing that's designed to make her feel uncomfortable.
Yes.
And that didn't feel right to me. Like it felt wrong and it took me out of the movie. I was like, I don't know. That's not what would happen.
Yeah.
You know, like they would scramble to change the name card on the seat, and they would, you know, like,
yeah,
they would scramble to find out something about the guest. And
yeah, I don't know. On the one hand, like, sure, it kind of makes sense, because what, like the whole concept of the menu, like, small t, small m, the menu, is that the service staff does not feel appreciated or understood. So yeah, sure, they can be rude people. But on the other hand, like the irony is that they keep the facade, they keep the servant heartedness of it until the very end.
Right.
So in that way, it's a little bit incongruous. Yeah.
Right. Like, because like with the food, for instance, you know, like the food that they're serving near the beginning of the meal, it's like impeccable, right? And so I don't know why the service wouldn't also be impeccable, you know, up to the point where it, where you find out that you're on the menu or whatever. Like, you know, so that, that felt a little weird to me. And then one thing that felt like a little bit off about their understanding of like high and fine dining as well, to me seemed like they were talking, there was a lot of talk about how like all of the products came from the island Hawthorne that they were on. And, but then also, there were several points during the meal where they said that they had gotten ingredients from, there was chicken thigh on the, one of the dishes, and they said that it was breast chicken thigh. And I was like, you know, they have a chicken coop on the island. So I was like, okay, like why are they importing chickens from breasts when they're, when they have their own chickens? You know, like that just didn't feel.
It's kind of a, you're right. It's a mashup of two different styles of high-end restaurant where like you have on the one hand, like, I don't know what the best, like I think a lot of the old school French chefs in New York, like Jean-Georges and Daniel Boulud, like sure they use like New York produce and stuff, but they also like, they're bringing in like yellowfin tuna from the Pacific and all that. Like they,
Or they're bringing in truffles from France whatever.
They just like they're like a global chef that wants to just, if it's the best in the world, that's what they're pulling from. And then contrast that to the René Redzepi's and the Magnus Nilsson's and that like hyper local.
And this, the movie to me felt like it got those two things a little bit confused. Like I know that they're not totally mutually exclusive, but it felt to me a little bit confused about that. Like
in a way, I take the point. I think that there are some that like even say, so like Thomas Keller is supposed to be a champion of like local producers in Napa around the French Laundry. But like at his restaurant per se in New York, like they have fish from the Gulf of Mexico and they have produce from California and they have stuff. Like, so I know what you mean. It does. It definitely tries in the movie. It tries to paint Hawthorne more as the Nordic style, hyper local,
as like a hyper local kind of thing.
You're right. Yeah. It has some elements that don't jive with that.
But it's a minor quibble. And then like the actual cooking and plating. What did you think about that?
So cooking, I don't actually remember seeing very many like direct. You certainly see all of the plates, all of the finished dishes. Cooking itself, I don't remember seeing actually that much. The food, I can kind of rattle off some of the actual, the courses that are actually food, because some of the courses aren't really food.
When you get to the first course that's not really food at all, that's when the movie takes a really crazy, disturbing turn.
The fourth course. And that course is called The Mess. But anyways, so like when they get on the boat to travel to the island, they're given a snack. And I didn't get the full descriptive copy, but I wrote down that it was oyster, lemon pearls, mignonette, and some kind of foam. So that sounds nice. Like it doesn't, it's not groundbreaking, but it sounds great. Like I would eat that. The amuse-bouche, once they were on site, it was cucumber, melon, ash, lace, and snow, some kind of snow, and I can't remember what it was actually made of. But the
The
food critic who was dining there that evening made some kind of snide remark about how every chef is trying to put snow on things now. Anyways, and it looked, again, like it looked very contemporary. It was like little perfect kind of like miniature Parisienne balls of cucumber and compressed melon with a jet black ash lace circle around it and some kind of white snow. It looked contemporary. The flavors, I don't know, cucumber and melon. I had that on a menu last fall, so I don't know. It sounds
it looked like a very contemporary plating. Definitely interesting. Artistic, I would say. How do you think they made that snow, Alan?
Well, I can't remember what the ingredient was.
Pacojet.
Oh, right. Sorry. Yeah, that's a running joke. Yeah, the Pacojet makes many appearances.
There's a running joke about Pacojets in the movie, which is, I think, pretty hilarious. That's really on the nose, actually. Mm-hmm. Having a joke, a running joke in your movie about Pacojets is pretty on the fine dining nose.
The first proper course, I regret to inform you, I only wrote down scallop. I know it was a composed plate, and I don't remember any of the
other. Oh, yeah. It was called the island, I think.
Oh, right. It was like a single scallop placed. Sorry, you just jarred my memory. Jogged my memory. That's what I was trying to say.
Jarred and jogged.
You didn't jar my memory.
I jogged it, and then I jarred it right up.
If I remember right now, it was a single raw scallop or barely cooked scallop.
Yeah.
That was just placed on top of this little, almost like a diorama of the island. It had rocks and moss and seaweed and stuff like that. None of which you actually.
And a bunch of edible plants.
Oh, did it? Okay.
From the island. Yeah. Like a bunch of like little herbs that were like the things that you're supposed to eat. And then I think the food critic or something said that like some of the herbs were like coated in like a flavored ice or something.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, sounded interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's basically like a scallop with some herbs placed around a rock to look like a rocky island. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The next course, and this was one also that I think harkens to that older idea of the snooty waiter who doesn't want you to be happy. But it was called breadless plate. So it was ostensibly the bread course. And apparently they had made delicious bread from red fife wheat, which is also kind of weird because that's a prairie thing. But beautiful sourdough red fife bread. But they didn't serve it to the customer. So they made the bread, but then it was not served to the customers. And what was served to them was, I think, 7 different savory accompaniments to the bread.
Right.
They didn't tell you what they all were, but it was just like 7.
But I'm assuming one of them was like butter, and then it looked like one of them was jam, and maybe one was like, like a balsamic. I think there was like an olive oil and balsamic.
Right. That kind of thing
there or something. Yeah. So things that you would normally get with bread.
And so this is the first time in the movie where the customers are all of them upset or disappointed about what's going on. And they start to straight up ask if they can have the bread and get their first kind of resounding pushback from the service staff and say no. And actually, there's a good line from that kind of surly hostess character, Elsa, when someone asks for the bread. She says, "You'll eat less than you desire, but more than you deserve," or something like that. Or tonight, you'll eat less than you desire, but more than you deserve.
Yeah, and she says it in a very menacing way too.
Yes, yeah.
That's where I guess at that point is where there's no longer any question that like something sinister is happening.
Well, there is question though, because this is where the kind of like Emperor's New Clothes aspect of fine dining enters in full force, where we have I can't remember if they say the name of the publication, but like she's basically a New York Times food critic. Lillian Bloom is the character's name. And she's dining there with like one of the other editors of the magazine. And at this point she starts to, even though everyone is disappointed or angry that they are not being served bread, this is where she starts to like, basically like trick everybody unwittingly trick everybody into like this is part of the pageantry, this is part of his like, this is like part of the act, part of the, he's trying to say something to us about food. And and she gets some, I don't know, she doesn't get very much, she gets some buy-in I guess from people, but like she is like basically gaslighting everyone unwittingly, like she's like she's trying to interpret it and trying to, I guess, like what she's setting her like intellectual prowess onto it to try and interpret it and redefine it so that it's still brilliant. because she's we find out she's the critic who quote unquote like discovered this the chef, Ralph Fiennes' character.
Yeah. And then also Tyler, who's like another one, sort of like the other kind of, I guess, main character-ish type of person. Mm-hmm. He is also, yeah, like fully bought in.
Yes.
You know, whatever the chef puts in front of him, he's, you know, going to try to appreciate it as best he can. He's like a, I don't know, like a manic foodie.
Yes. Yeah.
and his dining partner, Anya Taylor-Joy's character, doesn't really get it, and he's trying to explain it to her, but then he starts to get kind of mean about explaining it to her because he's like, oh, you just don't understand.
Yeah.
Like, really, it's genius or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, he and the food critic sort of at this point are like both like, you know, still fully under that, yeah, Emperor's New Clothes kind of sway of, you know, this chef that they've come to, you know, like, come to experience this like unforgettable meal that they're
right
that they're hoping for.
There is one thing with the bread course that I don't think I have any hard evidence, but in my mind it is also an allusion to 11 Madison Park. And okay. I can't remember if this came up in our, because we had an entire conversation about the 11 Madison Park cookbook and some of the ideas and techniques that are in there. And I can't remember if this came up, but one thing that was so dumb, shocking to me about the 11, the first 11 Madison Park cookbook.
Oh, are you going to talk about the broken emulsion?
Yes. So, or broken sauces. So like at 11 Madison Park circa 2010, they were making beautiful, perfect, defatted, cohesive French reduction sauces to serve with meats like lamb and beef. But then they were adding fat, like just rendered fat to it at the last minute so that it's like, it plates like a split, like an unemulsified vinaigrette. There's like this base of rich reduction sauce with spots of fat all through it, which classically is a no-no. You take pains to make sure there is not fat, like unemulsified fat in the sauce, but it looks cool and it probably tastes great. And so when they serve the seven accompaniments to the bread that is not present, one of them is an emulsion, and the food critic pokes at it and says, I think this emulsion is split. Well, you wouldn't expect that at a place of this caliber. And they're kind of muttering about it at the table, and the chef, Ralph Fiennes' character, Chef Sawick, I think was his name, right? He overhears it and actually just then sends them an extra cup of this sauce. And the server puts it down in front of them and says, here's some more broken emulsion for you to enjoy, or something like that. So like put a fine point on it that it's intentionally broken. Intentional.
Yeah. Which I think is a little weird that the food critic didn't understand that it was intentional, but then they really like, you know, push it in her face. Yeah. And then they bring her like a little cup of the emulsion. The server puts it down kind of in a rude way in here and is like, yeah, here's some more of this broken emulsion for you to enjoy. Mm. And then like, I think it's like right at the end of that course, or maybe like right near the beginning of the next course or something, they bring her a huge bowl of it, like a salad bowl full of it, which I thought was pretty hilarious. Yeah. Well, and then we get to the fourth course.
Oh, no, the third course.
Oh, okay.
Third course is Taco Tuesday.
Bread second course. Okay. Oh, right. Oh, yeah.
So this is one like where the storytelling goes into overdrive, and we hear, first of all, we learn that Chef Sawick's mother is in the dining room.
And it's a very like kind of, it's a weird like psycho kind of moment. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, where his, like he says some weird stuff about his mom and you're like, is this guy all right?
Yeah, she's dining alone and she's nonverbal throughout the entire movie and drinking a lot. And he relates a story from his childhood about his alcoholic and abusive father. getting into some kind of fight with him, like a physical fight with him on Taco Tuesdays, and someone being stabbed and dark stuff like that. But the food itself is a chicken thigh and house-made corn tortillas. The chicken thighs have small decorative golden scissors stuck into them because that was an element of the story that he told, someone being stabbed with scissors. Yeah.
I mean, I think the story was that he stabbed his father in the leg with a pair of scissors because his father was like attacking his mother, right, or something like,
yeah,
that.
And then more importantly to the plot, all of the tortillas that are served have laser engravings on them that have been customized for each guest that they're being served to.
Right. And so maybe, I don't know, maybe we should go kind of like to quickly go through who the diners were. So there's like a rich older couple.
Yeah.
And they don't, that's sort of like their whole personality, is that they're a rich older couple or something.
Yeah.
They don't really get into specifics about what they're,
you yeah, don't know what their business or, is, but you know that they're yeah. regulars there, and that the man especially doesn't really like the food that's here, doesn't think much about the food that's served there.
And then there's the food critic and the magazine editor, yeah, or whatever. Mm. And then there's like three kind of tech bro guys. They're, yeah, like, maybe not tech bros, what they're like, I don't know.
You find out, like, yeah, they're in finance, they're like, I think.
Traders. Yeah, yeah, they're finance bros, I guess. And then there's a famous actor and his assistant, maybe?
Yeah, or mistress or something, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Who's played by, what's his name?
John Leguizamo.
John Leguizamo, yeah.
Oh, he's trying to be the new Stanley Tucci. He's sneaking into all these little food movies. Yeah, because yeah, he's right, in a chef.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, well, maybe, yeah, maybe he's a, maybe he actually is a big foodie, mm-hmm, or something. And then there's Anya Taylor-Joy and Tyler. Mm-hmm. Is that everybody?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Hey? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you were closer with 12. And so the finance bros on their tortillas are all these like printouts of like spreadsheets that show that they've been like embezzling money and hiding it in the Cayman Islands or something.
But,
and they actually work.
Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, no, go no, ahead. Yeah, they actually work for the company that finances the Hawthorne restaurant. Mm-hmm. So like their boss is like the head of this company, and they're like the main investors in the Hawthorne or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so they think that, you know, they're a big deal and that, you know, the restaurant should do whatever they think that, you know, they when they ask for bread with the bread course, they, you know, they tell the server, don't you know who we are? Right. Like, we own this place or whatever. Yeah. And then
the food critic has images of restaurants that have closed allegedly because of the bad reviews she gave them.
Right. Yeah. And then the older rich couple, the wife has a picture on her tortilla of her husband, like, sort of like having a clandestine meeting with a woman in another restaurant somewhere. Right. So it looks like she's looks like he's been cheating on her. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they even say what was on his tortilla.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
And then
Tyler,
the foodie.
Tyler had, yes, yeah, I do, because at the beginning of the meal, Elsa, the surly hostess, says to everyone, you must not take photographs of the food that we're serving, oh, right, tonight, right, because it's supposed to be of the moment. And it's just for you tonight. It's this special thing tonight. Please don't take pictures of the food. But Tyler, every
just like
bite,
constantly, yeah, snapping photos,
just trying to,
and you would, yeah, think, oh man, this is another thing that kind of like bothered me a little bit. Like, they say, please don't take photos. And then he can't help himself. He has to take photos, I guess, for his blog or whatever. Mm. But then, like, he leaves the, like, camera sound turned on his phone. That really annoyed me. I was like, This guy's an idiot. If he's trying to be secretive about taking pictures, you would think that he would put his phone on silent, but guess not. Anyways, yeah, on his tortilla were like photos of him taking photos of his food.
Yes.
Which was pretty funny. And then, yeah, for the actor and his assistant or whatever, there was something about, I can't remember. I can't remember what was
actually
on their
tortillas.
Actually,
I don't remember it all. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, yeah, I can't remember.
So then the guests are getting kind of freaked out now because it's one thing
because
for
everything is like
front of house to know your name and where you're visiting from, or if it's an anniversary, but it's another to have access to financial documents and things like that. So,
yeah.
And then the fourth course, are we just going through the whole menu? Is that what we're doing right now?
I think like, so it made sense to talk about like the food and the presentation of the restaurant while we're talking about like the first three courses. But once we get to the fourth course, it doesn't really make sense to talk about that anymore. So maybe we can talk about the rest of the courses as they like sort of more apply to the sort of the political observations that the movie is making.
Sure. Although I will say that dessert, the plating and presentation of dessert is 100% a nod to the Alinea. I don't know what the official name is, but the painted table dessert that they serve at Alinea.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, I believe it's like prominently featured in the Chef's Table episode on Grant Achatz. But that is a very clear, yes, that's a rip from Alinea, or a
yeah,
nod
totally.
To Alinea, I guess.
And actually I have like a really specific observation about that when we get to it. But yeah.
The fourth course is called The Mess, and this is where really the bottom just drops out. Basically Chef Sawick brings out his sous chef to the
right. First they bring out a tarp and they put it on the floor in the middle of the dining room.
Yeah, it doesn't,
and they put like some branches around it and stuff.
Yeah, you're right. It is a tarp. It does look like, it's not like, it looks like a tablecloth.
It's white.
Yeah,
it kind of
looks
like a tablecloth.
It could be part of some kind of interesting, elegant presentation. They bring out this white cloth, put branches around it. Chef Sawick says that his sous chef actually conceptualized this course. So he brings the sous chef from the kitchen to the dining room and starts asking him, the sous chef is very almost militaristic, like he's standing at attention, he's answering questions very directly, very briefly. And the questions start to become things like, maybe you remember more of the specific show, but like, are you happy with your life?
Are you happy with the amount of sacrifice that you've had to make to get where you are? Oh yeah, the first thing that Chef Sawick kind of says is that, like, this is my sous chef. He introduces him. He's like, he's not very good.
I think he says
he's never going to be
he's
me.
Good, but he's not great, like, right? Like,
he's good, but he's not great. He's never going to be a great chef. And then he asks the sous chef, like, is that true? And the sous chef is like, yes, chef. And then he asks him, yeah, like, a bunch of other questions, like, about, is he happy with his career? Is he happy with what he's having? Is he happy with what he's had to give up to get to where he's at, even though he knows he's never going to get to where Chef Sawick is? And he says, no, he's not happy. And he's like, would you want to trade me? Like, would you want to trade your life for my life? Like, not my position, not as the chef or anything, but like, you know, would you want to live my life instead of your life? And he's like, no, chef, which sort of indicates that they both have like really had to sacrifice to get to the point where they are in their careers or something like that, that it's been a really tough road for both of them. And then basically the sous chef just like pulls a gun out of his pocket and blows his brains out in the middle of the dining room and like falls back on this tarp, and they just like wrap him up in the tarp and like take him away. And that's the course. Do they even serve food for that course?
Not that I remember. No.
Yeah. I don't think so.
And so as ridiculous as that sounds at this point, still the food critic is insisting that this is like a brilliant piece of theater to accompany the food.
Which, I mean, honestly, if I was in that dining room and that happened, I think what would be going through my head too. I would be like, this is not real. This can't be real. Mm-hmm. Like, somebody's trying to prove a point here, and it's a disgusting point to prove, but, you know, there's no way that someone just like died in front of everyone. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like it would be pretty easy to be in denial about what just happened in a situation like that.
Yeah. I think it's pretty obvious. Like, it's so like, it's such great satire. Like, the, what that is saying about the work culture and the abusive leadership systems in kitchens like this, like it's all right there. I don't think there's much to dissect about it. Like, it's,
yeah, no, it's like, it's very obvious, like what the movie's trying to say. And then like, it's sort of, and then that's sort of like when the bottom drops out of the movie, then, you know, like as a viewer, you understand that, like, you know, they're not here for a dinner. Everyone's here to like, to die probably. Mm. And then the movie like quickly moves through, you know, everyone sort of discovering that and what, you know, and how everyone reacts to it, I guess, is sort of like what happens in the next little while in the movie or whatever. And then they all sort of realize that also they can't really get away.
Right.
That they're kind of like trapped on this island, and even that they're like trapped in the building. Is it right after that that the guy tries to throw a chair through the window and run away?
Could be. I'm not sure.
Everyone realizes that the glass is like tempered glass and they can't break it.
Mm-hmm. I can't remember. I didn't write this down, so I don't remember where it happens in the progression, but sometime around here, and I can't remember if it's, it must be after the mess, but it's not a course, but they kill the restaurant's angel investor, the primary owner of the...
Oh, yeah. I think that was right before the mess for some reason, but I could be wrong. Might be right after. I don't think it was a course.
No.
Oh, yeah. No, it was.
I don't know. No, I don't...
I think it had a name. Anyway, they also... Yeah, there's one of the things that happens is like they... The investor for the restaurant, they put angel wings on him and drown him in the sea out in front of the restaurant so that all the diners can see. And then the chef says that he's free or something. Right. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After the mess, the fifth course is the palate cleanser, which is probably the last real food that most of the
actual food
folks eat. But it's a bergamot and red clover tea. And then the sixth course is called Man's Folly. And at this point,
right,
all of the guests are taken outside and the men are told that they are free to run. They get a 2-minute head start and they're free to try and to escape. But that after 2 minutes or whatever, that staff will be chasing them and bringing them back.
Right. And before that, there's like an introduction to the course where the chef introduces another one of the sous chefs, and she's a woman. And is it him who describes like the abuse that happened or whatever, or is it her?
It's her
who describes the abuse.
It's her. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So she introduces the course. It's like her concept. And it's about how when she first arrived to work with, the chef, that he like made advances towards her and she rebuffed him, and then he like basically it like stalled her career because of that. Mm. And, you know, made it very uncomfortable for her to work there. And this course is like her sort of like payback for that. And the first thing that happens in the course is he stands there while she stabs him in the leg with a pair of kitchen scissors, the same way that he did to his father or whatever on taco night.
Mm-hmm.
And then they tell the men that they have a chance to run away and that they have a 2-minute head start. And so all of the men leave pretty unceremoniously. And then all of the women are taken back into the dining room and fed some food, and they just sort of like sit around and chat.
Yeah, they are fed food, and I didn't write down what they ate, and I can't remember it for the life of me, but
I can't remember what it was exactly either.
There was one.
Something relatively simple, I think.
Yeah. It's such an odd, oh, this is This is a weird conversation show. Just like that, the fact that there's recording of me saying these things, like, and then they ceremoniously drowned the investor. Like, it's just, this is weird.
I know, it seems so crazy.
But there's one, possibly what I thought was like just the one of the funniest parts of the movie. So I can't remember which character. I think it was the magazine editor. He was the last man to be caught. He like all of the men were eventually caught and brought back to the restaurant. But the magazine editor who was accompanying the food critic, he was hiding in the chicken coop. And then this is in a weird bit of coincidence, maybe. When they find him, they give him like a little bonus, kind of like a bonus hors d'oeuvre.
And right, it's like a reward for being the last one to be caught, and it's like a special little dish that only he gets to eat.
And it's a Passard egg, but he was in a chicken coop, right. So I don't know, that was a weird coincidence, but
I think it was a funny
I've joke. Never heard it called that, but I think it's like the famous egg dish from L'Arpège by Alain Passard. It was just like, it was done so abruptly, and like, it was kind of like, and here you go for being the last man caught.
They hand it to him through the window of the chicken coop. The like cook who's there to like capture him and bring him back to the restaurant just like opens up the window of the chicken coop, and he's like, "Here's your reward for being the last one caught. It's a Passard egg. Please enjoy."
It was just a great juxtaposition of servant mindedness and also horrific. Violence
and hostility. And then while the women are dining in the dining room while the men are out being chased around, the like older rich woman finds out that her husband had the woman who he had met with was Anya Taylor-Joy's character.
Yes.
And it turns out that she's an escort, I guess. Yeah. And then the sort of like what has been happening behind the scenes that we haven't really talked about is that the chef sort of feels like Anya Taylor-Joy's character is less the type of person that he wants to like punish as these like the like in the same way as this room full of people that he thinks are horrible people, and he sort of feels like she belongs with them in the kitchen because she is in her own way in the service industry and understands the sacrifices that he and his staff and people in the service industry have to make and should therefore understand the point that he's trying to make by doing this murder-suicide pact thing or whatever.
Yeah.
And because of that, he gives her a choice to like be with the kitchen or be with the diners. And then how is it that she is allowed to, she's sort of like, I guess he sort of decides for her that she's going to be with the kitchen, and then he gives her like an errand to run. And so she's given this errand. She has to go to like their smokehouse and bring back this barrel that apparently has some food in it that they need. And then there's like sort of like a little subplot where she goes to get this barrel, but she finds a knife, which seems like it's been planted there on purpose. And then the hostess comes to get her, and she tries to defend herself with the knife and winds up killing the hostess. What was the hostess's name
Elsa.
Again? Elsa, yeah. Right. So they have a bit of a fight. The chef has a house on the property. Nobody's supposed to go there. Anya Taylor-Joy's character goes there to try and see if there's a way that she can communicate with someone and save everyone on the island, and she gets confronted by Elsa. They have a fight, kind of a knife fight, and then she winds up killing her by hitting her with a Paco jet, basically.
That's right. Yeah,
they're like throwing things at each other, and she pulls the Paco jet off the counter and hits her full on in the face with it, and it like pushes, like Elsa has a knife, and it like knocks the knife into her.
But actually, one of the funniest things, because it, on the surface it's funny, but also in terms of what it's saying about the industry, I think the funniest line of the movie is when Elsa comes to pick up Margot and take her back to the restaurant. You think it's like a, you know, I'm the hostess. I'm bringing you back to the restaurant. You think, but what she ends up saying is, are you trying to take my job?
Oh yeah.
She thinks that, Margot is like maneuvering to become the hostess of the restaurant. And so they fight.
Even though they're all going to die that evening.
It was like such a,
it was really good.
Such a savage, or I don't know, savage, insightful kind of take on industry politics and maneuvering, but
that was a beautiful little piece of satire.
Also that, like, little, I think shortly before jealousy. She dies, sometime earlier, Chef Sawick, he sends Margot on that errand and says, I told Elsa to do it, to bring the barrel to the restaurant, but she didn't. And then basically right before she dies, Elsa says, I didn't forget about the barrel. He never told me. Which I thought was such a classic.
Oh man, that is I missed that actually. Thing. And that is a perfect like little piece of satire too. It's like, that happens all the time. It's like, I asked you to do this thing. Well, okay.
And you don't say it.
I mean, I'm not going to tell you that you didn't ask me to do it, and I'm just going to do it, but you actually didn't ask me to do that.
Yeah. But it's on this little detour into Chef Sawick's personal residence that Anya finds a radio, and she thinks that she contacts the U.S. Coast Guard to come in.
And then she goes back to the dining room and kind of tries to like wait it out until the Coast Guard is going to come or something like that. But also while she's in Chef Sawick's house, she like sees some pictures of him. Like he has like a little bit of a little altar with some pictures of him from when he was a younger chef. And there's one that's like, looks like he's like really young, like in his teens, and he's working in a burger joint and he looks super happy. Yeah. And so, she's like, oh, you know, like you can tell that she like sees this picture and she's like, oh, I think I have some leverage on this guy now or something.
Yeah.
And so, she goes back to the dining room and then was there another violent course? I can't remember. Or is that when they ask Tyler to cook?
In my notes, actually, Tyler's cooking actually happened before Margot's sojourn.
Oh, okay, okay, fair enough. Oh, you're right.
But there's a course that's called Tyler's Bullshit. And to me, this is straight up like a chef. This is like revenge porn for chefs. This is... The know-it-all foodie being dragged from the dining room into the kitchen and being asked to cook a dish, which doesn't go very well. I know he was cooking lamb. I didn't write it all down.
Yeah.
He melted butter. He sweated leeks and shallots,
butter,
And then tossed in some rack of lamb and didn't cook the meat and then put it on a plate. And
because he just got so anxious and nervous, like having to cook in front of all these people who, like, you know, he had built up in his head as heroes or whatever. And he has this, what would you call it? Like a trivial knowledge of like food and its preparation. Mm. But like, you know, obviously he doesn't really work in the industry, or maybe he did briefly or something, but when put on the spot, he doesn't really know, you know, he knows that he's obsessed with tasting food, but he doesn't really know how to do anything with it. And so they force him to cook, and it's just like this really harrowing, like really, I don't know, the like intensity and the anxiety in that scene was like pretty crazy. Like I've felt that way in kitchens before, maybe not to that extent, but having to do something on the spot in front of someone who has like really intense expectations of you is like harrowing in that same way. He like goes to put stuff in the pan and the pan has been on the heat for a really long time, and he drops the butter in the pan and it immediately burns, and he goes to pick the pan up off the heat and he burns his hand. And it's just like, it's like all these things that have happened to me before, and I was like, you're right, it's sort of like revenge porn for chefs against people who think that they know food but they don't really know anything about it. But at the same time, it was like very much like
also
gave me the feeling PTSD. Of being a commie in like a really intense kitchen like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like it did a good job of representing that, I thought. Mm-hmm. And so then the chef tastes the dish that Tyler made and he's like, yeah, it's not very good. And then they call that course Tyler's bullshit.
Right. Yeah.
And then the chef whispers something in Tyler's ear. And then you see later that he's gone and hung himself in the back of the restaurant because he feels so degraded.
Yeah. And this is something like it's really over the top and it's satire, but this is like, I don't even know how to talk about it properly.
It's so intense.
Yeah. And it's
like,
it sounds like we're describing it so briefly. It sounds like it's all this hilarious joke. But like, obviously it's talking about the, actually, we've talked about this before, but, this movie made me think, and this part of the movie made me think about that, the Joe Beef guys, Dave McMillan and Fred Morin, they have that piece that was in Lucky Peach called The Art of Toilet Cleanliness. Right. We've talked about it before, but there was a specific paragraph in that, and I'll read it to you if you don't mind.
Sure.
So they're talking about that culture, that exact culture of like the toughness and the abuse, and also the fact that there's so many unpaid workers competing for jobs in that system. Mm-hmm. And something that Dave McMillan says in that piece is, and those kitchens don't make better cooks. Once in a while, there'd be a kid who was the one who didn't collapse, the hardest little worker ant on the anthill, a kid who'd been there in at 5 in the morning and would leave at 1 in the morning. If he fucked up the eel, he'd burn his arm with a pan and show it to the chef to prove he was worthy of staying on the hot line. But for every little Lance Armstrong, there were dozens of casualties. It was a system that made broken men who drank too much to cope with it. That's what I thought of when I, like with that,
yeah,
that part of the story in particular. So yeah, it's like this, the environment is like this pressure cooker where, yeah, 1 in 100 people like really get pushed to the limits and do something new or something difficult, but then like the
right, but
the,
most people get pushed over the limit and wind up in a really
bad place, yeah,
bad situation.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, and I think like that's on the restaurant side of the movie, that's sort of like the largest overall point, I think. Mm-hmm. Is that like, you know, restaurant culture is toxic in a way that it is like ruining people's lives, even though they appear to be extremely successful. And that's sort of, yes, like what the chef is trying to illustrate with his conceptual menu. Mm-hmm. That and a few things.
Yeah.
But that I think is like the main thrust of it. Mm-hmm.
And if I were to, it's funny because I generally think of this as like, oh yeah, this is something that's born of the, you know, the top 50 list. And when I think about the kinds of restaurants who are operating this way, I'm thinking of Levin Madison Park and Noma and, you know, the Dan Barber one, the Stone Barns at Blue Hill or whatever, like that kind of, yeah, thing. But then if you can go back to like 1988, Marco Pierre White, the yeah, kinds of interviews that he's giving and like the BBC miniseries that he's on, like, they're talking about this exact same thing. And even not just the toxic culture and like the long hours and how it affects your family life and all that, but also at that time, there are chefs talking to Marco Pierre White saying, I wonder if it doesn't need to be this way. Like, I wonder if there's,
right,
like, you know, you're a young chef and like you have a young family. I wonder if there's like a way to balance this all out. And that was 35 years ago. And we're kind of in the same place. Like, I think a lot has changed, yeah, but like,
yeah, I think a lot has changed, but I think there are pockets where it hasn't. You know, it's sort of like all of those things that change over time in our society is like, you know, people get, you know, really, like pushed to the limit, and then some change tries to happen, but then there's pushback, and it's just sort of like a back and forth. But like, I do feel like, you know, progress has been made, or at least there are pockets where you can find, you know, jobs in this industry that are more progressive and less toxic and, and things like that. I mean, I'm sure some of those things always existed too. Like, I'm sure that there were people in the industry 35 years ago who really did take that seriously and thought it was very important and tried to do something about it. But, you know, it's sort of like trying to bail out the ocean with a bucket or something. Right. And I mean, maybe you can do it eventually. Yeah. And then so like everything with the diners and everything is, you know, everything is like totally off the rails by this point. Everyone, I guess, sort of like realizes that nobody's getting off the island alive. But then the Coast Guard does show up.
Yep.
And everybody's like, oh, yes, thank goodness we're saved. And then so this Coast Guard officer comes in, and the chef and the host, they like sort of like clean everybody up. Some people have cuts and scratches from being chased around the island, and Anya Taylor-Joy is covered in blood from getting in a knife fight with Elsa. And so they try and make everything look normal. And then this Coast Guard officer comes in and looks around and asks some people some questions. And the chef tells him that, like, you know, if they tell the Coast Guard what's happening, then, you know, they're going to have to kill the Coast Guard officer, and he's an innocent person. He has nothing to do with this. So, you know, if you have any sense, you'll just keep your mouth shut, and which I don't think that would actually work, but it works in the movie. And so the Coast Guard officer comes in, and nobody says anything, but then he gets suspicious anyways. And so he like levels his gun at the chef, and then everyone freaks out and is like, yeah, no, they took us hostage and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out that the Coast Guard is just like one of the chefs, and he's just there to get their hopes up and then to subsequently dash them or whatever. Yes. So after everyone gets excited that the Coast Guard is going to save them, then he throws his gun down. Oh no, he uses his gun. It's actually not a gun, it's a lighter, and he uses it to light a candle on the table, and then he walks back into the kitchen, and then everyone's really sad. Yeah. And that kind of brings us close to the end of the movie. And basically, I don't even know how to describe the ending. The ending is really weird, I thought. Like, I thought it was good, but I thought it was really weird. What did you think of the ending?
The ending, like the hamburger part of the ending?
Yeah, the hamburger.
Oh,
the cheeseburger.
It was great. It made perfect sense.
Yeah, it sort of. Yeah, like it did. But yeah, it was also like, I don't know, in this like, yeah, it makes perfect sense in this sort of like satire playland that we're in, I guess.
Yeah, in the landscape of ideas, it makes perfect sense. Because while everyone else is just pleading for their life, Margot,
whose name is actually Aaron,
I think
at some point. Yeah.
Appeals to Chef Sawick's early passionate connection and interest in food.
And she kind of like, she does this like weird play where she like sort of follows like the rules of a restaurant.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the chef is there to provide them with an unforgettable experience that they're, you know, going to savor theoretically. And she claims that she hasn't had a good meal.
Yeah.
And so, and you know, basically calls out the chef, saying, you know, like, I'm not satisfied, I want to send my food back. Mm-hmm. Like, this isn't what I wanted, I don't like this, I want to send it back. And so and so that kind of catches Chef Sawick off guard. Mm-hmm. I think, because he's like, oh, this is like diner, a customer of mine who I'm supposed to be pleasing, and they're dissatisfied. Obviously everyone in the room is dissatisfied, which is why I thought it was a little weird. But she's the only one who like thinks to sort of like call him out in this way,
right?
And so he gives her an opportunity to order something that she would like, and so she orders, because she saw him in the picture working at the hamburger restaurant when he was like little, she asks him to make her a cheeseburger. Mm-hmm. And so he makes her this like lovingly prepared cheeseburger with crinkle cut fries and brings it out to her. And then she takes a couple bites and she's like, oh, I don't think that I can finish this. Can I get
it
to go?
Well, first of all, she shows immense gratitude. She takes a bite, truly savors and enjoys it, and says, now that is a cheeseburger.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And then she says,
and it's clear that she actually is being sincere about it.
And then she says, my eyes are bigger than my stomach. I'd like the rest to go, please. Or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. And then so he packs it up for her and just sends her on her way. And she runs out to where like the fake Coast Guard boat was and gets on the boat and figures out how to drive it off the island. And then they have dessert.
Yeah. Which is starts off, as we mentioned, as a kind of, a parody of the Alinea painted table dessert depicted in Chef's Table, based on s'mores. So it has graham cracker elements and marshmallow and chocolate elements. I was definitely laughing out loud at this part. The customers each get draped in this kind of like shawl or cloak
made out of marshmallows.
And get little chocolate hats that kind of look like a fez kind of hat. And then they light the place on fire.
Yeah, they light the whole dining room on fire, and then everyone gets roasted like a little s'more.
Yeah. And all of the cooks in the kitchen turn off the pilots and turn on the gas, and then the island explodes. That's the end of the movie.
Yeah, and the whole restaurant goes up in flames. And then Anya Taylor-Joy's character looks back at the island from the boat and sits on the front of the boat and enjoys her cheeseburger while the whole place goes up in flames, which was pretty sweet.
Okay.
Got anything to say about the s'mores
now
island?
Now that we've reenacted the entire movie. No. Like it... No, I don't have anything to say about it. It other parts of the menu were kind of cheeky, high-end versions of common food, like our Taco Tuesday course. And this is more of the same. And it has the pageantry of the painted table. And
except it's not painted table. They paint the entire floor of the dining
room.
Right, yeah. Which is kind of cool. Oh, yeah. And the other thing that I wanted to say about the painted table or whatever, that famous Alinea dessert where they put like a silicone tablecloth on your table, and then they just plate all these like different dessert sauces and little components and things directly on the table, and then you just eat it right off the table. So I saw some pictures of that dessert plated, and then there are a bunch of pictures of that dessert in the Alinea cookbook.
Oh, really?
And
I didn't know that.
I think so.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty sure. Anyway, I saw a bunch of pictures of that dessert.
Mm-hmm.
And the sauces that are plated on the dessert. So like there's like, you know, you see this like fairly often in like modern plating where there's like a big dollop of sauce and then one that's like adjacent to it that's like slightly smaller and then slightly smaller and slightly smaller and slightly smaller until it tails off kind of in a curve, like little dots of sauce. But like in the Alinea dessert, a bunch of the dots are square.
Oh, okay.
And I was always like, how do they do that? Are they using like a mold to plate the sauce or something? But then I saw a video of them plating it and they're just like pouring it out of like squeeze bottles onto the table and it's making like these square dots. And I was like obsessed with figuring out how they did it. Turns out that it's just like the texture of the silicone mold that they use. It just like when you put a dot, it just like spreads in like different directions instead of spreading in a circle. It just like there's a grain in the in the silicone tablecloth, and that grain causes the dots to spread like further out, like in perpendicular directions, and so you get these like weird square dots, which I thought was like super crazy.
So how did you
I don't know if
out?
It was intentional or if it was like a happy accident or Alan, like an ungodly amount of like research and asking questions online
Like until one day Grant Achatz did an Ask Me Anything on Reddit and you were just like, finally.
I wish, actually. Yeah. But no, I can't remember exactly how I found out or where I found out. But yeah, I found out that it's the silicone tablecloth that makes it do that. And I was a little bit disappointed because I was like,
well, I mean, it's always disappointing to find out how a magic trick is done, right? So
yeah, totally. That's true.
Okay. So can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
I think it's pretty like for, not for everyone, but for us, it's pretty obvious what this movie is saying about high-end dining culture and workplace culture and things like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, I think there are some ambiguities. Like one thing about the movie that I was like, I don't know. I wouldn't say that I disliked about it, but that I found maybe a little bit challenging is that it's sort of like, I mean, it has to do this because, you know, it's only an hour and 45 minutes, but it sort of like picks and chooses the things that it wants to drive home a point about. And I think that like in doing that, some of the things that it's sort of like trying to have a conversation about get glossed over a little bit, you know, like some of the points are driven home like very poignantly and succinctly, but then there are like other adjacent like points or conversations that sort of like get glossed over, you know, for the, you know, in favor of the like fact that it's like a shocking kind of thriller horror movie and they, you know, want to do these like, you know, they want to do these shocking things or whatever. You don't really like, they bring up the issue and they illustrate a little bit about, you know, like why it's bad, but there's, you know, like there's not really a conversation there, you know, it's more just like, this is bad and we're going to make a point about it, you know? So that to me is like interesting to watch because I'm really aware of the things that it's sort of like making a point about. But I do feel like for someone that maybe doesn't have an ongoing conversation about these types of things going on in their head all the time, you know, like it might, like the satire may not illustrate the point to someone who's like on the outside of the service industry as well as it does to someone who's on the inside. I feel like, I don't know.
So that's actually kind of one of my big questions about this movie is, so to you and me, it's obvious what is being said about restaurant culture. But I guess my question is, do you think that, is this movie about something beyond restaurants and fine dining, or is it literally just about?
I mean, there's definitely like a broader point about classism and haves and have nots and upper class versus quickly diminishing middle class and things like that. Like, I think there is a larger point there. Just like, you know, the like the aspects of those issues that occur in the service industry are informed by like larger societal problems that, you know, that cause the things that this movie is talking about, like, you know, how, especially in this like fine dining world, you know, it's basically the poor feeding the rich, you know. I don't know, like I think it's more nuanced than that though. And I think that like, yeah, it, long story short, I think there's like a broader message in this movie, and that, you know, for people who don't have an intimate knowledge of like the service industry or fine dining, that message probably still comes across, you know, as just like a story about classism and someone who's fed up with it or something. And so I do think that people who are not necessarily interested in like food culture can watch this movie and have a good time with it and get something out of it. Like, it definitely has something to say.
Not just class, but also, you know, like what is it to be an artist or what is it to create something and serve people. So I'm really curious to hear what some of my friends and family who aren't in, who don't work in restaurants, if they watch this, what they think of it. Because really, it's a bit of a stretch for me to try and take this movie and apply, like, see if there's some kind of broad message about, it just seems like it's about restaurants. Like, it's about restaurants now. Yeah. It's about high-end restaurants
because
right
I'm
now.
So close to it. It's really hard to untangle the restaurant part of it from the, like, overarching message of it. Yeah, I totally
agree. It seems like
I look at it and I see, like, these very specific service industry issues. But obviously the movie is trying to tell a broader, or, like, has a broader point than that, but yeah.
I don't know. Well, this is what I'm asking. I don't know if it does.
Like, I think it does. I think it does. It felt like it did, but it's just so hard for me to not get hung up on the restaurant part of it, you know?
Like, really, to me, the kernel, the real center of the movie is the chef as martyr, chef as artist, chef as misunderstood, right, unappreciated, martyr artist. Martist?
Martist?
And, like, specifically chefs, like, because it doesn't do anything. There's nothing in the movie that's about anything else. Like, it seems odd to me that, like, this is a huge movie with famous actors, and it really does seem like it is about restaurant chefs, which is crazy to me, because even all the other like food movies that we've talked about are like, they have like broad nostalgic happy themes about food, but they're not focused like this. And like, this seems like such a niche thing to me. It's crazy.
I mean, Ratatouille is pretty focused on like restaurant culture, critic culture. Like,
it's got, yeah, it has,
I guess it's got family stuff. Yeah, no,
it,
you're right.
You're,
yeah,
you're,
it's got,
it like, definitely, it has aspect, the flavor of some of that stuff, but it's not really about that stuff. Really, at the end, most of those food movies, what they're actually about is food makes us happy. Like, you know what I mean? Right. Like, yes, there's critics, and there's like little bits of restaurant, like the real color and flavor of what it's like to work on a line. But the theme of those movies is food brings us together and makes us feel happy. All of them, from Big Night to Ratatouille to Babette's Feast, whatever other ones we've talked about. Maybe not Burnt. Burnt isn't even about food at all. So, But to me, that's what makes this movie so fascinating to me. And I wouldn't even say it's like, you know, a great food movie. It's like an actual specific satire and commentary on restaurant culture. It's amazing. I really like it.
I honestly feel kind of the same way. Like, it's a little bit shocking that it got made, that someone read this like screenplay and they were like, oh yeah, for sure. Like, right, you know, we can afford $60 million to see if this can succeed. Right. Like, that's, I don't know actually how much it cost to make, but it seemed like the budget of this movie was pretty reasonable. Like, the production value is, I mean, I guess it's like, has the benefit of like mostly being shot all in one location and stuff like that. You save a little bit of money there, but like, really, like, the production value looks really good. Yeah. Like, yeah. Anyway, highly recommend. If you're into like thrillers or horror movies and you're also in the industry, man, it's like, it's a special treat to get a movie like this.
It's a weird, it's so weird that it happened. So let's enjoy it.
Yeah, totally. You might as well get it while you can. And I do feel like, I know when we first talked about The Bear that we sort of said that we were going to come back and talk about it more. And I don't think we ever did that, did we? No. And I think we should probably aim to try and do that the next little while, because there's more that I have to say about The Bear. Okay. And a lot of it is like, similar to some of the conversation that we had about this movie. So,
okay.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.